Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Photo Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social.
Turn your tax refund into a new landscape with Menards. Make this the year you check that project off the list. Create stunning patios and build strong retaining walls with our huge in-stock selection of beautiful concrete blocks ready to take home today. Plus, easily build and design your own raised garden beds with our garden block. On sale now. Check out our weekly flyer and start saving on landscape blocks now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Hello everyone, welcome to episode 101 of the History Hotline. My name is Deanna Lynn Cook and I'll be your host today. Today's episode is all about William Cuffy and the Chartist movement, and I think it's going to be a two-part episode. So in this episode we're going to talk about his early life and upbringing. We're going to talk about the 1834 strike, which I think falls perfectly after episode 99, where we were thinking all about industrial action today in modern times, but we're going to take it all the way back to the 19th century this week. We're going to think about the Chartist and the Chartist movement and what they stood for and what they hoped to achieve in 1838 with the People's Charter and William Cuffy's role within the movement and some of the work that he did as a Chartist and in his earlier life. The majority of information for today's episode comes from two books in particular, African and Caribbean People in Britain by Professor Hakeem Addy, as well as Peter Fryer's Staying Power, which I reference all the time on this podcast. And speaking of both those books, they feature in the 100 episode giveaway that is currently running on the History Hotline Instagram. So if you haven't heard about that or checked that out yet, please go and do that. If you are listening maybe after this has been published or after a few weeks after it's been published, then it might not be running anymore. It's running until the start of April 2023. So if you are listening to this well into the future, I'm sorry that has passed. But if, you know, it is within the time, please go on Instagram and enter the giveaway. You just need to comment your favorite episode, tag three friends in the post and share it on your story, and you can be in with a chance of winning six books, I think, as well as a selection of exclusive merchandise from the History Hotline that has not actually been released yet, as well as some cakes from Bougie Bakes Cakes. And now on to William Cuffy. So William Cuffy was born in Chatham, Kent, although his first biographer claimed he was born on board a merchant ship. He was one of five children to a formerly enslaved man named Chatham Cuffy from St. Kitts and a local woman named Julia Fox. Now, records show that his grandmother, a woman who is on record as Linda Myra Cuffy, as well as his father, were both baptised in Chatham in 1772, suggesting that three generations and maybe more of his family were from that area. It was said his grandfather was, and I quote, an African dragged from his native valleys into the prime of his manhood, end quote. It suggested that they kept their connection to Africa through the surname Cuffy, which they were able to keep when they, as a family and the generations before, arrived in St. Kitts and then in Britain. Chatham was an area that had an important naval dockyard, of which Cuffy's father, William Cuffy's father, Chatham, was a dockyard worker and a cook on board a Royal Navy ship. Now, at this time, this kind of whole Navy element of this episode is important because Britain was literally waging war on the whole world, which isn't really uncommon in their history, but it was trying to expand its reach and subsequently the empire and its status as a global force. And so just a selection of the battles and wars they were in. They were at war in the Caribbean with the enslaved Ashanti people and Jamaican Maroons in Tacky's War in this period. There was the American Revolutionary War at this time. They were part of the French Revolutionary Wars. There was a second Maroon War in Jamaica, the Anglo-Spanish War, an Irish Rebellion in 1793, the Fourth Xhosa War, the Hundred Days War in the early 19th century, moving forwards a little bit, of course, the Napoleonic Wars that wrapped up around 1815. And yeah, as you can see, that list is not the whole list. That is a selection for you, a selection of the wars that were going on in this kind of period of the late 18th century and early 19th century. It was a time of significant battles, meaning that naval grounds were extremely important and significant places in 19th century Britain. By the beginning of the 19th century, the black British population ran into the tens of thousands. I think it's estimated around 15,000 at a point in the early 19th century, which often goes kind of unrecognised and unmarked as we look at mass migration to be a 20th century thing in the post-war era. But many of this population, unlike that of the people that migrated to Britain from the Caribbean, let's say, in the 20th century, had actually been born in Britain. Of course, they were marginalised by racism and often poverty as well. Opportunities for the black population were really concentrated on sailing. They were still the cogs in the wheel that was British imperialism, or domestic service oftentimes. Essentially, very little difference to the roles they would have occupied as enslaved people in Britain only a few decades earlier, when the transatlantic slave trade was still happening and enslavement was quote-unquote legal. Essentially, you know, black people within Britain at this time, and a lot of them would have been what we now define as being mixed race, they were still in positions and roles that meant that they were having to, you know, support the naval forces or support the domestic services of very wealthy people in Britain. William Cuffy grew up in this setting. He started off as an apprentice to a tailor. This gave him more agency than most, and his story is a little bit different maybe to the average person that would have inhabited Britain in this setting at this time. He was able to move to London in 1819 to ply his trade. However, ended up entering politics in 1834 after an unsuccessful tailor strike in support of improved wages and conditions. People have literally been striking since, I'm sure, the beginning of time. This phenomenon that we think is a phenomenon now, or some people do, in the modern day, is not. And William Cuffy was there in 1834, striking for better wages and conditions. It failed in the sense that they were not granted improved wages and conditions. And at this time, it meant Cuffy actually lost his job. And his lack of employment saw him become truly invested in politics, especially the politics of working people at the time. He was small in stature and is said to have had undiagnosed rickets. And he's kind of reported and spoken about as having a deformity due to a shortened spine and legs. However, it said, and I quote, he took great delight in all manly exercises. Like many, he lived in some poverty, and his first two wives actually died within their first few years of marriage, of which I assume to be ill health. And so there isn't really too much about them as you know, they weren't really alive for too long whilst married to Cuffy. But we do know that in 1819, he married an Anne Marshall, who died in 1824. And then a year later, he married an Anne Broomhead, and she died in childbirth in 1826. Their only daughter, Anne Juliana Cuffy, was baptised at St. Mary Magdalene's Church in Gillingham. But she also died shortly afterwards. And then he marries a third time in 1827. And I really expected her name to be Anne. And it kind of is, because it's Mary Anne. I don't know why, but William Cuffy had a thing for Anne's. And so for the third time in 1827, he marries Mary Anne. And she's quite a big part of his story as a Chartist herself. And we'll get onto a little bit more about her in this episode later on and in next week's episode. So back to those strikes, the tailor strikes of 1834. As I said, he lost his job, and in the aftermath of the strike, he was blacklisted and actually would never find regular employment again. But He had been charged up, he'd been propelled to take further action, and by the time the first Chartist petition had been presented to Parliament in June 1839, William Cuffy decided to join the cause. So this wasn't something that he started, it wasn't a movement that began with him, it actually began with MPs and people that kind of were, I guess, full-time in politics, not Cuffy. But he joins this cause, splitting from the Liberal Party to be part of the Chartist movement by October 1839. He was also one of the organisers of the Metropolitan Tailors Chartist Association, which, you know, is coming from his job as a tailor and his call for better working conditions and for better pay. Now, you might be thinking at this point, well, who were the Chartists? What was it all about? I mean, I'm going to get into that now. So, Chartism was arguably the first major movement of working class people in Britain, which emerged in 1836 in London. It expanded rapidly across the country and was most active between 1838 and 1848, which is a period we'll be looking at this episode and the next. Their aim was to gain political rights and influence for the working classes. Their demands were widely publicised through their meetings, pamphlets and their petitions, and there was one particular petition populated at Chartist meetings across Britain, which was brought to London in May 1838 for Thomas Attwood, an MP, to present to Parliament. They worked to gain support for their cause through, you know, working class people that were employed in a variety of fields. And in 1838, a People's Charter was drawn up for the London Working Men's Association, the LWMA, by William Lovett and a Francis Place, two self-educated radicals, in consultation with other members of the LWMA. And the charter had six demands, and I'm going to go through the demands because I remember learning about these in school in terms of looking at universal suffrage. And I thought it was interesting that they've come up again because I used to always ask the question in my history lessons, like, you know, oh, were there any black people in this? Like when I thought about the suffragettes and that kind of thing. And no one ever told me about William Cuffy, this mixed race man that was such a big part of this movement when I was learning about this. So I just thought it was quite interesting that this kind of charter that I had learned about prior, and don't get me wrong, William Cuffy wasn't really that active as a Chartist when this charter was being written up. He joined kind of a little bit later on in the movement, but, you know, his name was never referenced in regards to this really large and original movement for working class people in Britain. Okay, so the 6 points of the charter, the six demands, all men to have the vote. Voting should take place by secret ballot. Parliamentary elections every year, not once every 5 years. Constituencies should be of equal size. Members of Parliament should be paid, and the property qualification for becoming a member of Parliament should be abolished. I'm going to go through those individually because the thing is, the system we have now, whilst in many ways is imperfect and not really that representative in my personal opinion, the system that has, you know, was there in the 19th century was even worse than the one we have now. And these kind of movements to change the system when we think about politics, you know, are really, really important. And I think we take for granted the system we have now. Democracy hasn't always looked like this. And it's interesting as the current government bring in things like voter ID.
Moro Casino. America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at rss.com.
D's and, you know, a lot of policies that might be unfavourable to some, it's interesting to see how voting reform has kind of happened over time. Now, this idea of universal suffrage, the right to vote, when the charter was written in 1838, only 18% of the male population that were adults in Britain could vote. So only 18% of the population, the male population, so not, that's not even the women, they're not involved at this point. There's like no chance they're getting the vote. This is like 100 years too early for them. Well, not a whole 100, maybe about 70, 60. So only 18% of around half the population can vote. Well, how is that representative in any way, shape or form? And before 1832, it was only 10%. So this charter proposed that the vote would be extended to all men, all adult males over the age of 21, except for those that were declared insane or convicted of a felony. So that would have been extending voting rights to more people. Still not to women. It would have been for men over the age of 21, which, you know, is still far off from where we are now, where everyone can vote over the age of 18. Still not people that are in prison, though. The second point was the property qualification. And it meant at the time, potential members of parliament had to own property and it had to be of a particular value, which meant that the vast majority of, well, the population really couldn't really become MPs or stand to be elected as MPs because they weren't wealthy enough, essentially. So obviously, as you can tell, this means that upper class people have a complete hold over politics and the political arena. And it's not a space for working class people because they don't qualify on the basis of their assets and the things they own. And as we know, assets tend to be passed down from generation to generation. So that just keeps a certain set of families very wealthy, property owning, and able to be part of politics and to make changes and impact the lives of the rest of the people in the country, even though it's literally a majority working class place. Well, you know, the working class is always a majority in any country, but this kind of small propertied upper class can run the show. The third point was annual parliaments instead of once every 5 years. And this meant that governments could keep power as long as there was obviously a majority of support. And it made it difficult at the time for them to replace a bad or unpopular government. It sounds really familiar to me. and so, yeah, they wanted annual parliaments. The fourth point was the idea of equal representation in regards to constituencies. In 1832, there was a Reform Act which abolished this idea of pocket boroughs, which was a parliamentary constituency that essentially was owned by like a single patron who could basically control the whole borough and essentially decide the two members that were going to represent their borough in parliament because they had so much control. In some of these constituencies, it was like six people or so that could elect two members of parliament because of the sizings and the shapes of the constituencies. So that meant that six people had such influence. And when we think about A, the people they're nominating and voting for being so wealthy, these people could just buy votes, essentially. And the second point, or the last point we're going to talk about, is this idea of voting by secret ballot. It wasn't done in a secret before. So you knew exactly who was voting for you and you could make sure that your investment paid off because you watched them vote. So the Chartists proposed a division of the UK into 300 electoral rural districts. And they had like equal numbers of people living in those areas. And it meant that there would only be one representative for each district to sit in parliament, which is obviously a little bit more like what we have today and the system that held up. So the fifth thing was a payment of MPs. They were not paid for the work that they did at the time. Obviously, they're paid now. But it meant that people obviously couldn't become an MP unless they were wealthy, because you would have to have had some like earnings to survive. And so you would either need to have just be very wealthy to become an MP, Or you couldn't do it because you weren't going to get paid for it. It was like voluntary work. Who can afford to do voluntary work? People that already have money. And essentially, the charter was proposing that MPs get paid an annual salary of £500 in order to make it more accessible to people that were not just rich or from the upper classes or wealthy to become MPs and to also have some influence in the political sphere. Something, again, that we have today. So I think one thing I will say, and as I read these all out, it's quite interesting to note that a lot of the things that the Chartists wanted are things that we have embraced wholeheartedly in our political system today, and have done for the past, well, over 100 years in most of these cases. And so, you know, it's hard to understand how much they were fighting for this at the time, because things were so different, and these are things that we might take for granted for today. But these were literally things that people were so against. They were happy with the system they had that represented pretty much wealthy people and allowed them to keep control of Britain. The sixth point that the Chartists wanted was a vote by secret ballot, which I've already touched on. Voting was done by showing hands in public, as in you'd all sit in a room. And it was called hustings, where there would be a public platform, candidates for parliament would be nominated, and then the people, obviously the wealthy people that were allowed to vote and of the age, would go and vote. But it meant that all the people, everybody could see how you voted, not just the people you were voting for, but your friends, your family, landlords, employers. They could see how their tenants and employees were voting. And it just meant that there was like no kind of privacy in regards to voting, and your vote could be bought and they could check on their investment. And also, you know, it was just probably quite uncomfortable for a lot of people that may have not wanted to vote for a certain candidate but had to because everyone was going to see a no. And I'm sure it caused a lot of problems. It wasn't made secret, voting, until 1871, which probably gives you a kind of taste of what happened to this Chartist list of demands in their petition. The petition, I will say, you know, had more than 1 million signatures, 1,280,958 names. Written out, it was 3 miles long. The petition was 3 miles long. Let that sink in. 3 miles. I don't think I've walked 3 miles for a very long time. 3 miles long with over 1 million names. And Parliament voted not to even consider it. Of course they wouldn't. Like, it's not in their vested interest to at all change the system that benefits them, which is what we see now. The vote wasn't even close, to be honest. 235 votes to 46. Or 235 nays to the 46 A's, as they say in the one of the houses, the House of Commons, that's the one. The Chartists were very disheartened after that, as you would be, you know, a 3 mile long petition. Do people even do that anymore? 3 miles long. Of course, we do all our petitions online for the most part today, but the idea of it is just crazy to me. But they did continue to campaign for the 6 points of the Charter and actually produced 2 more petitions to Parliament in the years that followed. Now, I'm going to wrap this episode up thinking about what William Cuffy did within this movement, and then we're going to go next week and look at what happened in 1848 and how William Cuffy ends up in Tasmania, exiled. William Cuffy joined the Chartist movement in 1839 and emerged as one of the dozen or more so prominent leaders of the movement. He was not the only black Chartist at the time, but he was one of the first. In autumn 1839, Cuffy was helping set up the Metropolitan Tailors Charter Association, and about 80 people joined on the first night. In 1841, the Westminster Chartists sent him to represent them on the Metropolitan Delegate Council, and in February 1842, Cuffy chaired a great public meeting of the Tailors, at which a national petition to the Commons was adopted. He was elected to the National Executive of the National Charter Association in 1842, and later that year voted President of the London Chartists. He was appointed chairman of the committee for managing the procession, responsible for making sure that and I quote, everything necessary for conduction of an immense procession with order and regularity had been adopted. Whilst he was often described and known to be quite mild-mannered, he was known also as being very militant, and his militancy earned him recognition in the press of the ruling class. He was in favour of heckling at meetings of the middle-class complete suffrage movement and the anti-Corn Law League. The press was often racially charged and Punch lampooned him quite savagely, and the Times often referred to the London Chartist as, quote, the black man and his party. And as a direct result of this press campaign, his wife, Marianne, who I said we'd mention again, was sacked from her job as chairwoman. She was also an active and very popular Chartist. This also led to Cuffy being known to carry a loaded pistol due to the way that he was being attacked in the media. And he would carry that with him at all times, and this would come back to haunt him in the future. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Cuffy made some of the most radical speeches at conventions, openly denouncing some of the leading Chartists who were more cautious. He was part of the movement that really condemned what the government were doing, the injustice, the cruelty of it, and the way that they were exploiting working class people. He was very militant in his desire to see change, and really didn't suffer fools, and by the fools I mean the people that were kind of higher up within Chartism and of the more wealthier classes that were kind of half-hearted in their approach to change. But as I've said before, he was racially targeted in the press. He, of course, was a black man and racialized so in Britain. And the way in which he is often presented in press at the time really does lead to some problems. And it really does lead to him having quite a large target on his back. And this target puts him in a lot of problems as we get into the 1840s and 1848 in particular. So that is all we have time for this week. We will be finishing the story of William Cuffy and just going to find out how he ends up in Tasmania, exiled. Unfortunately, it is a sad story, but we will get to the end of it next week. So thank you so much for tuning in. Check out the giveaway on Instagram for 100 episodes if the time is still right. And I hope you have a great week. Thank you for listening. Goodbye. The History Hotline is hosted by Deanna Lynn Cook. Research is done by Zakia Riaz. To continue the conversation about Black, British and Caribbean history, follow us on social media at The History Hotline on Instagram and at The History HL on Twitter.
Moro Casino. America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
You're listening to a podcast right now, driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at RSS.com.